It was 1963, a warm summer's night in the heart of the English countryside. The biggest robbery of all time was about to take place.
I saw the lights of the train coming towards me, picked up the walkie-talkie and said, "This is it, this is it, this is it."
Bruce Reynolds was the mastermind behind this audacious plan. A plan so well executed, the gang fled with a staggering £2.6 million. How did they do it? This is the story from the man who organized it all.
First I heard about it was, of course, on the radio news. It came up to say that a Royal Mail train had been hijacked in Buckinghamshire, and it was thought that rather a lot of money might have been stolen. What an understatement that turned out to be.
All day, scores of cars, motorcycles, bicycles have been arriving at the gates of Leatherslade Farm, where the mail bandits hid with their loot for a few days after the train ambush.
It was Buster that woke me up and he said it's £2.5 million plus, you know.
The council chamber has been packed all day. Piled in a corner, a great stack of exhibits, an axe, three pickaxe handles, mailbags, boiler suits, sleeping bags, and eight tea chests crammed with yet more exhibits.
The Fleet Street Press was styling it the crime of the century. 2.6 million was stolen. Today would be about £33 million.
The great train robbery entered the history books when a highly organized gang stole millions of pounds from a Royal Mail train. In just 30 minutes, 15 men had hijacked the traveling post office and offloaded the cash. But its success was down to its perfect planning. Well-known career criminal Bruce Reynolds believed he was just the man for the job.
I was recognised as a face in the underworld. I was 32, full of abuse, so it was just really a question of finding the right, as we used to call it, a piece of work. We wasn't that far away from the end of the Second World War, so when they say swinging 60s, it was certainly swinging 60s. I was drinking in the Star Belgravia with Billy Hill. Industrialist film producers, all those debutantes that like to mix with a bit of rough. I was going to the same tailor that Cary Grant went to in driving sports cars of all types at that time, because that was also a mark of who you were in the world. There's a network that was supplying the inner circle of thieves with information.
One of these thieves was Gordon Goody, a well-established criminal with good contacts in the underworld. His connections with the solicitor provided the key Bruce needed.
A crooked solicitor said that he'd got information about a possible major robbery. He knew about a mail train coming from Glasgow to London. He said that the figure that had been mentioned to him had been 1 million to 6 million. As a thief, this is what you're looking for all your life. This is a chance to fulfill, let's say, romantic fantasies and also enable me to literally retire from crime.
When jobs like this turned up, you either had the contacts to make it happen or let the opportunity pass you by. Bruce grabbed it with both hands. This was serious cash. Well known in the criminal underworld, he was fresh from a robbery at Heathrow Airport.
I'd been involved or wanted for questioning, as the euphemism goes, by Scotland Yard over the airport robbery. It was a well-organised robbery, and as I say, got great press acclaim, met up with my friends, and of course my enthusiasm infected the others to an extent. I said, we've got to get to work, and we've got to get to work with something that's going to be worthwhile. I was the motivator. I was the one who had the enthusiasm. I was the one that made sure everything was looked at from my point of view rather than leave it to someone else.
But a robbery on this scale was going to take some doing. It wasn't a job for opportunists. It needed the right team. And Bruce knew just the men. 31-year-old Charlie Wilson was a big-time criminal who Bruce had worked with before. 34-year-old Ronnie Biggs was a one-time carpenter turned small-time crook. Crucially, he could supply a much-needed driver for the train. 32-year-old Buster Edwards was a former boxer and nightclub owner and a long-time confidant of Bruce, a man he knew he could trust. What none of them knew was that this robbery would make them household names.
The nucleus of it was all people that I'd worked with on previous robberies, and you know, they knew how to keep their mouth shut and security minded.
Making up the rest of the core team was Jimmy White and Thomas Daly.
When things had to be sort of drawn out, Buster wasn't living at home. He'd rented a flat in Twickenham, and we'd have meetings over there where Black Belt was brought out, and you know, you'd point out what the situation was. And, you know, literally thrash it out. The idea was formed. As there at Bicester, there was an army barracks that if we had been interviewed by the police, you know, we was dressed like roughly sort of more military than railway. I was in charge of the operation as the major, and I would inform the policeman that we were on a military exercise.
Bruce quickly realised he needed more men he could rely on. Stopping a 135-tonne locomotive was going to need a few heavies.
If there's 1 to 6 million, we need bodies to handle the bags. Plus, if things do go wrong on the track, we've got something like 80 people on the train to contend with. We wanted someone who knew railway procedures, who knew how to stop the train for sure. So Buster knew the South Coast Raiders, he knew one or two of them, and he knew they'd got a guy, Roger Caldery, who'd arranged for various methods where they'd stopped trains successfully on the South Coast line. So you have the big guys, they're the attack team, and the little guys and the technicians.
The gang was in place, 15 men, all ready for a slice of the action. But months of planning lay ahead, and in the underworld where secrets are hard to keep, Bruce was desperate to keep this one well under wraps.
What you're trying to do is not to excite any attention, you know, keep a low profile, and if you're going to meet, particularly in large numbers, you've got to devise some sort of method. I mean, we used it to take a ball over to Wimbledon Common and, you know, kick it around a little bit, and then you go into a huddle when you say, this is the plan. One of my mentors said to me, Bruce, you've got to think you're a spy in an enemy country and behave accordingly, that everyone is out to capture in some way or another. So when we had sort of meetings, we kept it as little as possible that we weren't together at any particular time.
Bruce knew people he could trust, but that wasn't enough. He had to know more about the Royal Mail train and its contents. An old contact proved to be the inside link he needed.
It was well known that railways carried a lot of money at various times, but to get the specific information is very difficult. Just the mere fact you know that trains carry money, well, that's not good enough. I went to see a contact of mine who was only a porter at Waterloo Station, and he outlined to me what trains came in with money, and there was what he termed a money train. He didn't know how much was on board, But what he did know, there had to be a lot of money because of the police presence when the train was unloaded.
The pieces were fitting together, but the perfect robbery wouldn't be a success if the perfect location couldn't be found, and time was running out. Bruce set to work visiting potential spots to hijack the train.
A lot of them were quite content, you know, to let me do the donkey work, to let me look at where we could stop the train. I found what I thought was a perfect spot. It was adjacent to a B road where there was a bridge with a culvert. The perfect spot to stop the train and unload it. The place we'd chosen, it really adjoined three counties, which of course always makes it difficult if a robbery has taken place. The counties get mixed up, who's handling it?
The location was spot on, but he also needed a base and somewhere to split the cash. He found it at Leatherslade Farm.
The decision was made that we should find a place where we could hide out rather than drive back home. It was 17 miles as the crow flied from Brigo Bridge to Leatherslade Farm. The crooked solicitor said he got someone who would buy the farm for us. A deposit was put down and we were allowed the keys to actually go ahead with it. So we sorted out where the train was going to be stopped. We worked out where the hideout was. We worked out a route from Brigo Bridge where the robbery would take place. With that, I think virtually everything was complete.
Everything was set. Months of preparation all came down to this one night. If it went to plan, the 15-strong gang would be made for life. But if it went wrong...
How you sort of make your mark in any walk of life, whatever your profession, is by results. We've got two Land Rovers, both with the same registration plates. Perfect night, beautiful weather, countryside, you know, it was absolutely marvellous.
But just as the atmosphere intensified and the gang got into position, a message came through to put everything on hold. It looked like it was all over before it had even begun. It was the night of the biggest heist of all time. A gang of prolific criminals was about to hijack a Royal Mail train carrying millions of pounds. But just as everybody was ready to go, word came through to wait.
We've been told a date, the August bank holiday. Everyone was at the farm. Someone cycled out to a village some couple of miles away and phoned through the contact. And he said, no, you have to wait till tomorrow. After a bank holiday, obviously, just spending all over the country. So banks had excess money.
It took the banks a few days to collect the extra money for transportation to London, which meant a jackpot even more than originally thought.
So the contact said, you have to wait till tomorrow. That's when the major money is coming through. It was a day later than it should have been.
The promise of more money was enticing, but in the meantime, the gang had to sit and occupy themselves.
Then we had a lull, really, in the enthusiasm. 24 hours delay meant people started thinking, hold on a minute, the enormity of this crime we're about to commit could have devastating results with us. So there was a bit of rallying that had to be done.
Bruce's reputation kept the gang's morale together. They trusted his word and laid low at their hideout for 24 hours.
You're part of a group, you know. You can't suddenly say, I don't want to be in it now. You lose face with your comrades. They knew my provenance, you know. They knew that I was a very sound man. They knew that I'd been quite successful in lots of robberies.
This was the biggest job of Bruce's criminal career. Everyone knew the drill. They went in hard, each man armed with a cosh. But it was to prove a mistake.
So I was playing my role. It was like a commando raid. I was dressing the part, even wearing a SAS beret. We left the farm, perfect night, beautiful weather, countryside, you know, it was absolutely marvellous.
But how were they going to stop a fast train without anyone noticing? The answer? Get the driver to do it. First, a glove would be used to cover the green light. Then the red signal would be rewired so it was under the gang's control. Next, the train would be stopped at Cheddington, where the two front carriages would be uncoupled and driven down the line to Bridego Bridge, where finally, the high-value sacks containing all the loot would be unloaded into the waiting vehicles. There was no time for any mistakes.
We was in position by about 3:30. The train come through at 3:00, so we had 30 minutes to cut all the telephone wires. We completely isolated the whole area as regards contact. So we knew that we'd have, you know, something like a minimum of 30 minutes start before people got off the train. It was really just a question then of splitting up. The attack team were at Bridego Bridge. I was further up the track to identify the train. It was all coming to fruition. I knew that whatever happened in the next sort of 30 minutes was going to change my life forever.
Now it was simply a case of waiting. As soon as the train could be seen in the distance, it was all systems go.
I saw the lights of the train coming towards me, picked up the walkie-talkie and said, "This is it, this is it, this is it."
My job on the night of the robbery was to sort letters for South East London in the fifth coach from the front of the train. Well, being after the bank holiday, there was extra mail on board. We normally only carried 30 to 40 high-value bags on a normal day, but after the bank holiday, there was between 120 and 130. There was a lot of pressure on, and there was extra staff employed to deal with the pressure.
When we got to where the red signal was at the gantry, the train ground to a halt. Paddy and I are sitting in the Land Rover just waiting to see the train and its two carriages pull away from the other 10 carriages that formed the train. For a moment, you know, it was silence.
British Rail were doing major engineering work on the West Coast Main Line, so no one took much notice of the train coming to a stop.
The mail train was carrying over 70 staff, too many people for the gang to take on. The front carriages needed to be detached and moved so as not to arouse suspicion and buy the robbers time. But uncoupling a train requires experts and time, neither of which the gang had.
Then we heard sort of clanking as the train was taken apart, and very, very slowly, almost imperceptibly, the engine and the two coaches and one container high-value packages pulled away from the rest of the train, and with that, we then drove up to Bridego Bridge.
The gang needed to move fast. They'd lost ground detaching the carriages and in the hurry had burst some pipes. Little did Bruce know that the driver had also been attacked in the rush.
And the next thing I knew was a masked man was climbing up the steps. I grappled with him. I almost forced him off the footplate, but I was struck from behind by another. The next thing I remember, I was on my knees on the floor, and I was told to get in my driving seat, take the train forward and not look up.
We'd attended to Mills, who'd been hurt in the attack, and his fireman, who hadn't been hurt at all. They were handcuffed on the embankment. I think Charlie Wilson gave one of them a cigarette, put a bit of a bandage round his head.
I walked through to the front of the train to see what was going on. And in the leading coach, I noticed that the gangway door was open. And that's where the high-value coach and the stowage vehicle and the loco had come detached. And it was quite a way down the line. But at that particular time, there was nothing sinister apparent.
Inside the train, the mail workers remained oblivious to what was going on.
Charlie Wilson opened the door and a chain was formed and the bags started coming down the embankment, passed from one man to another, onto the back of the army lorry. I kept checking my watch to make sure everything was all right. I'd allowed a half an hour to unload the train. We'd got to 120 bags and I checked my watch and said, that's it. Someone said, well, there's 8 bags left behind. I said, well, we've got a timetable, we'll stick to it. And with that, the 8 bags were left there and we drove off to Leatherstow Farm.
The gang had done it. They'd shifted over 2 tons of cash in half an hour. As they drove off with millions of pounds, the workers on the rest of the mail train began to realise something was very wrong.
After about 40 minutes, a member of the staff that was in the high-value coach, he came back to the main portion of the train and said that robbers had attacked the high-value coach and that they had taken most of the high-value bags. Had he not done that, no one on the train would have been any the wiser.
It was a beautiful night, and I could vaguely hear people were singing in the lorry behind, and they were singing the Tony Bennett number, The Good Life.
The officer in charge of the travelling post office, he detailed 2 postmen to go to a local house and raise the alarm. Everybody was in total shock that it could happen, that the Queen's Mail had been taken.
The largest robbery in British history had been pulled off by Bruce Reynolds and his gang of train robbers. 120 mail bags containing more than £2 million had been stolen from a Royal Mail train in just 30 minutes. As workers on the train were left dumbstruck, the 15 robbers thought they were home and dry.
It was almost like I smelt victory. We had a VHF receiver. Just as we pulled in the farm, it came over on the police message. It said, you won't believe this, they've just stolen a train.
I mean, when I got there, all there was part of the train and post office workers all looking out the window, wondering what the hell's gone on.
The first I heard about it was, of course, on the radio news. It came up to say that a Royal Mail train had been hijacked in Buckinghamshire and it was thought that rather a lot of money might have been stolen. What an understatement that turned out to be.
We finished up doing the fingerprint side. The actual track had to be photographed, the signals, which have all been interfered with, the wires on the telephone were cut.
As the sheer scale of the raid dawned on the local police forces, the gang was tucked away at its hideout.
All the bags were stacked up inside. Contrary to what you've seen in films, it was no loose money. It was all parcelled up in individual parcels, so there was a job for someone to open them all up and count what we'd got. I think it was almost verging on sort of a euphoric hysteria. August the 8th, which was Ronnie Biggs' birthday. So, you know, everyone was sort of making gestures towards Ronnie, you know. There's a tenner, you know. There's 1,500 quid, you know. I mean, that was it. It was just sort of playing with Monopoly, which indeed had been one of the pursuits to kill the time up there.
But for Bruce, the excitement of pulling off the crime of the century quickly subsided.
I was then absolutely sort of shattered. And I went upstairs and said, give us a call when you know how much we've got. And I virtually collapse onto the bed. And that's when, if you like, the euphoria of success faded a little bit. You know, it was almost like an anti-climax. I thought, well, we've done it, you know, what do I do now?
But just as Bruce was contemplating his next move, so were the police.
One of the robbers ordered the men on the train, stay in here for half an hour. Superintendent Futrell said, well, that was probably the half hour that they needed to get from the scene of the crime to their hideout. He had already got a clear idea in his head that the robbers would still be within the vicinity.
This throwaway comment may well have been their undoing. As the local forces scrambled to respond, the robbers had only one thing on their minds, the cash that would set them up for life.
I think it was Buster that woke me up, and he said it's 2.5 million plus, you know. So I said to him, you know, how do you feel about that? And he said, I think that'd do very nicely indeed.
Bloody right. Good.
Every gang member had an equal share of the loot, 150 grand, the equivalent of a staggering £3 million each today. As daylight broke just hours after the raid, most of the gang settled in to let the heat die down, but Bruce had his own plans.
We got contingencies that we might have to stay there some length of time. Hence, the place was well provisioned, more or less to last a siege of a month. But I left the farm the next morning and I hitched a ride into Tame, and I had two women friends who were antique dealers drive up with a van, and the bags was put into the back of the van. They drove off to London with it.
Bruce had a well-laid plan and stuck to it. For him, once the job had been completed, the safest option was for everyone to go his own way, quietly. While Bruce put his plan into action, he left the rest of the gang to its own devices.
Once the robbery was over, it's a dissolution of the team altogether. Everyone was going to make their own separate ways. There was a hint of madness about the whole robbery because we'd been in the frame, obviously, for the airport robbery, and the same degree of planning was present with the train robbery. So it was pretty obvious, you know, that we were going to get calling cards from Scotland Yard.
As Bruce made his quick exit, the others tried to adjust to their newfound wealth, unaware that their actions had made waves in the small village.
The local farm worker down at Oakley had become a bit uncomfortable and a bit suspicious of some comings and goings that he'd been seeing at the vacated Leatherslade farm. He had seen people working who, when asked, showed themselves to be prospective builders, decorators, doing work on the farm, ready for the new owner to move in some weeks later. Whoever it was, they seemed to have left some vehicles up there, which he knew didn't belong to the previous owner. They were a couple of Land Rovers and also an open-backed Austin lorry. And so he had phoned in, and after describing what he had seen, do you know, it was an attitude of, well, this might be worth your while to go and have a look at that.
The farm worker knew the area well, and if he was suspicious, it was worth taking a look. But had the robbers fled in time?
I opened the back door. We were in the kitchen. And that kitchen was absolutely chock-a-block with foodstuffs and provisions. It was everywhere. I'd seen a lot of sacks down in the cellar, and if those sacks contain the money that was stolen from the train, is it likely that having got it this far, the robbers are going to leave it unattended? And I started to think to myself, well, perhaps they haven't gone. Perhaps they're out amongst those trees, amongst those outbuildings, watching me. I'd got no illusions whatsoever that they were going to allow one young, unarmed village policeman to stand between them and a passport to luxury.
Bruce Reynolds and his gang had successfully raided a mail train and fled with over £2.5 million. whilst police forces from three counties were left on the back foot, the men were counting their hoards of cash. But the officers were closing in. The robbers' hideout had been blown and local bobbies were now on their trail.
I'd seen a lot of sacks down in the cellar, and if those sacks contain the money that was stolen from the train, I started to think to myself, well, perhaps they haven't gone. Perhaps they're out amongst those trees, amongst those outbuildings, watching me.
But the rest of the gang had left, leaving John and his colleague to scour the farm for much-needed clues.
The thing that struck us first and most forcibly was the house itself, because every one of the windows in that house was covered over. We had a walk round the yard, and then, of course, we saw the vehicles. A couple of Land Rovers and a big open-backed Austin lorry, an old army lorry. But the thing that really triggered it was when I spotted that the two Land Rovers both bore the same registration number. And I knew that weren't right.
The identical number plates had been a ploy to confuse people. But it wasn't just the Land Rovers the robbers had to worry about. Their hideout had been blown. They'd made their escape just in the nick of time. As for Bruce, by now he was well away from the scene of the crime and plotting his next move.
The heat was on everybody, and no one wanted to be caught with large sums of money. So I had someone who was going to look after my share, and he'd said to me, it's going underground, you won't be able to touch it for a while, so take what you need and give me the rest. And there's an old thieves saying is that you can trust any man with your money, your life, and your wife, but never all three together.
For the rest of the gang, trust was wearing thin. The farm that was now crawling with police was meant to have been destroyed. The solicitor involved had paid an acquaintance to set light to the building and destroy any evidence. Despite being paid thousands of pounds, he never did the job. Their secret hideout was now a treasure trove of clues.
One of their number was actually tasked with that job, and I suspect that in their parlance, cleaning it up would have meant setting light to it. And it would have burned out, and by the time a fire brigade had been summoned and got down there, it would have been a sea of hot ashes, taking with it all the evidence, all the clues, all the forensics.
No end of fingerprints there, yeah. You had plates, which were used, ketchup, there was the pipkin cans of beer, where they'd been staying there, living it up. I think they tried to clear it all up, but obviously they left quite a lot. You've got the transport problem of the lorries, the Land Rovers, all in garages. So they each had to be taken out, fingerprinted, and examined for forensic. Paint eventually was found on the pedals of one. You had all the bonfires that had been where they'd tried to get rid of stuff. It was a filthy job, really. I think it was one of the most successful cases that they've had, fingerprint-wise, in the country, really.
Investigators discovered more and more clues. As for the robbers, panic started to set in, and they quickly found themselves in a game of hide-and-seek with the police. Even Bruce was in their sights.
The desperate hours came in because I was picking a paper up and reading that, just like a game of dominoes, there was a new name that had been arrested the day before. I could almost taste the porridge that you get in prison. I thought that capture was looked like being inevitable. There was a knock on the door. Angela, my wife then, she opened it, and there was a policeman there. They said, is there anyone else here? And she said, well, no. And with that, I think I'd just got a pair of shorts on or something. I stood up, minus the shorts, completely nude. And Angela then picked up the cue immediately and said, well, I'm sorry, but my husband's away and this is a friend of mine. I covered up my best bits and they sort of didn't want to look and apologised profusely and left. You know, they got back to the station, so we just caught someone. husband's away and having an affair. Something as a joke, it wasn't him, was it? Because the photo had appeared then in the police gazette. And of course, crestfallen, the faces dropped. This became known as the French farce incident.
You've been had, son.
Bruce decided he couldn't take any more chances. It was time for drastic action. Especially now, the police had pulled in their first suspect, Roger Caudry, and were fast closing in on the others.
Right, team, give me an update.
I was just debating whether I should really go missing. I was drinking a bottle of vodka a day, you know, just to sort of stay abreast of it. I wasn't going out at all. I had my best friend who retired from being an active criminal, and he started arranging plans for me to move out of the country. We had connections with South Africa and we had connections with Mexico. In Mexico, who would be connected with the train robbery? Plus, I'd read about Mexico. I liked the idea of it. I thought, this is a place for me.
So while the other gang members were gradually all being brought to justice, Bruce was forging a new life.
By this time, of course, I'd acquired a passport in the name of Keith Clement Miller. Well, my pal arranged for someone we knew who was a pilot who would fly me out from Elstree to Belgium where I could pick up a plane for Mexico.
Bruce Reynolds was a very active criminal. He was big time. He was in a league right at the top. And I'm sure his name must have come into the frame relatively early. Although they knew that they wanted to talk to him, they wanted to interview him, Mr. Reynolds wasn't there to be talked to.
Most of the men in the gang thought the robbery was going to be their passport to a new life. But the reality was very different. Once they had the cold, hard cash, they simply didn't know what to do with it.
Most of the other members of the gang panicked and themselves got rid of all the money. Over £100,000 was found abandoned in a wood near Dorking. Another load was found abandoned in a telephone box near the Old Kent Road in southeast London. So, you know, people were now getting the wind up and they didn't want to be caught with all that evidence on their hands.
Months down the line, most of the gang had been arrested. Ronnie Biggs had been caught, but later escaped. The only robbers still at large were Buster Edwards, Jimmy White, and Bruce, who had settled nicely into his new life abroad.
We've got a penthouse, with it came a maid, and I deemed it was okay for my wife and my son to come over. For us, it was absolutely marvellous. We were very, very happy there. I mean, why shouldn't we be? You know, we was leading the sort of life I dreamed about, a Hemingway existence. We was going to the bullfights every Sunday, drinking champagne as always.
Bruce lived a high life for years, travelling the world and living off the spoils of his crimes. Other gang members were less fortunate. By 1966, both Buster Edwards and Jimmy White had been arrested. All the main men were now inside, with the exception of Bruce Reynolds, who was still managing to evade the long arm of the law. But officers were adamant they would catch the man behind the great train robbery.
Chief Superintendent Tommy Butler had a most distinguished service and was about to retire, but no, he decided that he wanted to carry on and see if he could bring this to a satisfactory conclusion. The conclusion, of course, being the arrest of Bruce Reynolds.
Pulling off a job like this.
Word was coming back to Scotland Yard that he had been seen in such and such a place, was believed to be using such and such a name, but either the country where he was supposed to be lodged wasn't cooperative or didn't have an extradition treaty with the UK, or that they'd moved on by the time they got over there. And so Bruce Reynolds remained at liberty for 5 years.
By now, though, Bruce was hungry for another job. His time on the run had been a whirlwind, and he was getting restless.
My mentor said there could be a couple of interesting projects if I came back to England. We was told that there was another one in Leeds concerning a post office van that was containing something like 5 million. And in the back of my mind, I thought, well, we can always do that robbery there. Then we can move anywhere in the world.
He was back on British soil. Little did the police know their most wanted man was just miles away. But it was all about to change.
I thought the fame that I'd got would enable me to maybe form another group and carry out some other robberies. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way because most of the people that I thought would want to work with me didn't want to work with me because looming over it was if you got caught doing anything with me, you're liable to get a much larger sentence than you would normally. Nothing was really working out. I realised the realities, which I didn't see before, that to be on the run with a wife and a son was very difficult, that say, even with money. Without money, by this time, of course, I was running very, very low. And as things got more and more desperate, I think that subconsciously I wanted to be caught. I couldn't give myself up. That would go against my whole sort of philosophy. So I was taking risks, and I was going to places where I shouldn't go, where I might have been seen.
Some of the senior investigators obviously took the view that this is my baby and I want to see this through to a satisfactory conclusion. It wasn't until November of 1968 that Bruce Reynolds was located living with his family down in the West Country.
One morning, the doorbell went, Nick opened the door and the police rushed in. The Grey Ghost, Tommy Butler, who was in charge of the flying squad at the time, made the usual remark, long time no see, Bruce.
Don't you coppers ever knock?
I knew I was Nick well and good. He said to me, you know, we've got all the evidence we need against you, Bruce. He said, you're down as one of the main ringleaders and there's nothing that can be done in that respect.
The game was over. It had taken several years, but finally, the ringleader of the great train robbery had been captured. It was the reward Tommy Butler and his team had long awaited. Bruce Reynolds was sentenced to 25 years. He served just 10.
If you get dealt certain cards in life and you play them the best way you can, I've got certain regrets in my life, but I can't change it.
As for the cash, was it ever returned to its rightful owners?
Of all the money, 120 sackfuls, 2.5 tons of money, 2,631,684 quid, less than £350,000 has ever been recovered or even accounted for. So that leaves a mind-blowing 87% of the original haul unrecovered, unaccounted for, never seen again.
It was also widely reported that the money was heading to London to be taken out of circulation and incinerated.
People latching onto this and believing it said, well, in that case, I expect the government's already replaced this money, already got it printed up, ready to put it into circulation. You know, who's the loser? None of the money was going for incineration or destruction or withdrawal, and it would have been recirculated. The Fleet Street Press were styling it the crime of the century. And that's how it's always been looked at since. And I think perhaps even today it still stands up to that title.
But what about the brutal assault on Jack Mills? Do the great train robbers deserve to be called folk heroes? As it was, the money proved to be a burden for most of the robbers, and some met gruesome and untimely ends. Buster Edwards took his own life, aged 63. Charlie Wilson was murdered in Spain, and Ronnie Biggs couldn't run from his ill health. He eventually turned himself in after years on the run.
Poor old Biggsy, you know, nothing much to do with it at all, except he knew a driver, he didn't know what it was all about, he never took part in any of the planning, he never even took part in the robbery, he never handled the mailbag till we got to the farm.
So, was it all worth it?
I live by the three C's, cars, crumpet and crime. Not necessarily in that order. The real sort of excitement is you can't really explain it unless you're sort of a one-man act. The great thing that I found about it was, as a crim, or a thief, was not only did you write the script, you became the star. I lived a life I wanted to lead, the Hemingway existence. He made his notoriety by writing about his experiences, and I suppose I made my notoriety by major robberies.